I was over in Nepal last time, and the thing about Nepal is their electricity is somewhat iffy. And so you'll have some slightly dodgy wiring. For example, one of our girls got electrocuted because she touched the plug socket that was in her shower. Okay, there was a plug socket in her shower. In my hotel room, the lighting cable that went from the switch to the light had been cut and attached to a fan. So there were just bare wires going up to this fan on the roof, and anybody could have just reached out and touched these live wires. It was just, but the other thing is, it's very unpredictable, the electricity in Nepal, because what happens is they have load shedding, so they have to shut down all the electricity every now and again just to shed some of the power. I don't know quite what the reason is. I don't understand the kind of process. But it means that certain periods in the day that people generally know about, everything just kind of goes and shuts down. And then, you know, when you least expect it in the middle of the night, suddenly everything comes back on again. You know, so if you've left your hotel light on and you've left your TV on in the hotel room, suddenly in the middle of the night you'll get this thing going on. And but we were out for pizza one night, you know, and there we were in the pizza restaurant having a lovely time, and sure enough, zoom, everything shuts down. And it's like one or two of us in the restaurant kind of thought, what's going to happen now? But everybody just carries on in the darkness. And then a couple of waiters run around with candles and put the candles down. And then you hear kind of, and the generators fire up. So they've got a way of coping with it. And it's amazing. But that night I went to bed. And at about 2 o'clock in the morning, I got out my BlackBerry because I kept having this poem running around in my head. So I thought I'd read it to you by way of introduction. And it's called Electricity in Nepal. And it says, written on my BlackBerry at 2:30 a.m. in a dodgy Kathmandu hotel room. Electricity in Nepal. She is the cruelest of lovers. She toys with your body clock. She zaps you with culture shock. She lures you in with her air of confidence, her switches and her sockets. So you trust her. You flirt with her. You plug in an appliance or two. You even take her out for pizza. Then she beats you and leaves you making the best of the evening with her much less attractive friend, the candle. So much the duller. Oh, electricity in Nepal, you are such a harsh mistress. You come and go, you ebb and flow with your alternating current. One moment I'm illuminated, the next I'm completely in the dark. You have me in your grasp. You play with my trust. I am broken because you are broken. And then, cruelest of all, you lull me to sleep. Generators stop their gyrating, machinery halts its vibrating, and I lie at peace. Your demanding has ceased. I sleep, perchance to dream. Oh, electricity in Nepal, can this be love? Alas, no. We are incompatible, you and I. It seems that as I am turned off, you are turned on. And with a frenzy of passion at 1 a.m., you attack me in the night with your power and your light. Me and all those other simple fools who trusted you and were admiring of your wiring. Oh, electricity in Nepal. If you want to be my lover, you better get with my friends. Make it last forever. Friendship never ends. Oh, electricity in Nepal. It's now 2:30. What can man do? But cruel mistress, feel at liberty to switch off. You need not flatter me, for I have eloped with Miss BlackBerry, and she has a battery. So Nepal is a great place to go if you ever get the chance. Just watch out for the dodgy wiring. I want to talk to you about a couple of things tonight. One, very briefly, I promised I'd share a little bit of my own testimony this evening. And then I want to look very, very briefly at the gospel. And then I want to just apply it in terms of your own attitude to the gospel. Okay? So that's where we're going to go. Let me just tell you a bit about my story. Because if I'm really honest, I'm probably the least likely Christian. Okay? And let alone church planter or church leader. I grew up in the countryside initially. My dad had a farm and life was idyllic, and then my parents split up when I was about 7, and my mum went one way, my dad went the other way. We went with my mum, me and my brothers, and we ended up having a small holding in Norfolk. And it was lovely. We had a great time there. But my brothers gradually went off to college. And my mum was very worried about me being left on my own with her. And she thought that wouldn't be a good situation for either of us. So I was packed off to boarding school at 11, which was great. It was just like heaven on earth. It was football. It was rugby. It was, you know, mates all the time. And I loved every minute of it. What I didn't realise was that the things that I missed out on were actually quite important things. And I ended up with having a bit more freedom than I had maturity for. So I made all the wrong choices, which is, you know, the start of a pattern that I've found in my life up until God got hold of me. And so at a young age, I started getting involved with heavy drinking and then playing in bands. I was a musician at the time, and we did a tour when I was about 15 or 16 of the area, and then we got, you know, kind of got some radio play, and so started touring wider. And to be honest with you, my life was just a kind of a battle of how much alcohol and drugs could I fit in before my head crashed on the pillow. And I woke up the next day and started all over again. And the drugs got heavier and harder, and the situation was getting darker and darker. I was getting weaker and weaker, and less satisfied, if I'm honest. But I couldn't seem to break away from it. I really couldn't seem to. I didn't have the resolve within myself to start again or to start afresh. And so I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go to another country. So I packed up my job, I packed up my flat. I had a Danish girlfriend, so I thought, well, I'll move over to Denmark. So I moved over to Denmark. The day I arrived, she dumped me, which was nice of her. So there I was, on my own, in another nation, not knowing the language, not having a job, and having given up everything to get there. But at least it was a fresh start. I'd left behind all my druggy mates, and I had a fresh start. And one of the first people I met over there, having lost my girlfriend, lost my job, lost my family, I kind of went into a bit of a pit of darkness, really. And I got invited to a party, and one of the first people I met at the party was a drug dealer. And so this was my first fresh start, really. But I really wasn't in the party mood. So he gave me a cocktail of different drugs to try and get me out of my bad mood. And I went up, it was in a farmhouse, and I went up that night to one of the bedrooms in the farmhouse, and I was just sitting in a chair, feeling really low, really out of place, really alone. And I looked up at the light bulb, single bare light bulb, in the middle of this kind of sparsely furnished farm bedroom. And I looked at the light bulb, and as I'm sat there, I can see the room around it getting darker and darker and darker. And then eventually, I just heard this kind of ting sound, and the light went out. And I just thought, I'm dead. I'm dead. I couldn't see anything. I couldn't feel anything. My initial reaction was, Mum, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to do this. But I knew that something wasn't right. The next thing I knew was 3 days later. Okay, I woke up in a hospital in eastern Denmark. I was paralyzed all down one side of my body, all down the left-hand side. And I'd been in a kind of unconscious coma state for 3 days, drug-induced. And as I woke up, I just knew that I'd survived, and I knew that I'd somehow been kept alive for a reason. And so I managed to get myself well again, got out of the hospital, found myself a job, continued to work over there for a while. But eventually, things being what they are, my old lifestyle came back again. And then I thought, no, I'm going to go back to England. I'm going to get myself a career, and that'll sort me out. And so I did. So I came back to the UK, and a friend of mine really helped, took me in, took me under his wing, and weaned me off everything that I was on. And I said, I'm going to go, and I'm going to train to be a teacher now. He said, great, where are you going to go? So I got a few brochures, and I spread them out on the table, and I looked at them, and I said, Winchester. That sounds nice. I'll go there. Winchester. Yes, that's the one I'll go to. So that was purely my choice for going to Winchester. I liked the sound of the word. That was it. Nothing. Not even sure I opened the prospectus, if I'm honest. I just thought it sounded nice. So I ended up going to Winchester, doing teacher training there. But as I arrived, this was my second fresh start, I came into the room, the student union bar, you know, and I don't know what it is about us druggy types. We can smell each other a mile off. And I saw this guy approaching me. He approached me, I approached him, and we worked out immediately that neither of us had anything to take, so we needed to go and find some. And within an hour and a half of moving to Winchester, I had found three pubs that I could score drugs from. Okay, this was my next fresh start. I had 4 years of that, going through university years. And completely hedonistic, completely rebellious, completely lost. Peer pressure, wanting to be liked, all of those kind of things. None of it really got me anywhere. Still continued to play in the band, still continued to do all of that stuff. And then one of my mates went out one night and he said, I'm going out on a quest. That's what you do when you're on drugs, you go out on quests. He thought he was King Arthur, I think, going on a quest. He went off on his quest. He said, I'm going to find out the difference between good and evil. And I kind of sat on my bed like you do, you know. I said, good luck, see you. Well, the next morning, him and his mate came back and they said, we found it. I said, what? He said, well, don't you remember what we were going on a quest for? I said, well, what? He said, we found the difference between good and evil. I said, oh, come on then, give me your answer then. And he said, it's Jesus Christ. And I just giggled, really. I did. I thought, you've just, what have you taken today, kind of thing. And I dismissed it offhand. And then, a couple of weeks went by, and I could see actually a change in their attitude. And I could see a change in their lifestyle. I could see a change in their own persona. They felt comfortable with themselves. And they kept coming round to my house telling me that they were going to church. And I thought, this is just utterly ridiculous. But I couldn't deny that something had happened to them. And that there was definitely a change in their demeanor. They were at peace, really, and I knew I was still pretty much in turmoil. And then I met a girl, and this girl was also a Christian, and all of a sudden, there I am, this little kind of pagan lad in the middle of this little group of Christians, and I'm thinking there's some conspiracy going on here. But this girl, so quietly, so gently shared with me her faith and her trust in Jesus, and I thought, you've got something I haven't got, and I don't like that. I just thought, you are so at peace with who you are. You're not striving for anything. Talk to me about it. So anyway, 6 months went by. This girl told me everything she knew about Jesus. She got me to church, and I went into the building, and I heard the gospel message clearly, really. And I responded at the end of the gospel message, and I went forward for prayer and ended up having an argument with the guy that was trying to minister to me. Yeah, I did blow it at that moment. Because he was saying that because I'd had some involvement with tarot cards, God would want me to stop that. And I told him I didn't believe in them. But he said, well, no, God would say it would be unhelpful for you. And I said, no, you're not listening, I don't believe in them. And he said, no, but God would just say it's unhelpful for you, and it's probably best not to do it. I said, yeah, but I don't believe in it. Anyway, this ping pong went on, and I walked out in a huff and went and got on the tube train back over to East London, where I was living at the time. So there I am, going over to East London, and I'm sat on the train, and my girlfriend, Jo, was sat down there. She's now been my wife for 18 years, but she was my girlfriend at the time. She was really fed up with me because, you know, I'd put my hand up, I'd gone to the front, I'd done everything right, and then I'd kind of had this row and walked out. And I was sat on the train, and this thought went across my mind. You plonker. That's it. That was it. I thought, what do you mean? What plonker what? And I suddenly realized that I'd been sticking up for the tarot cards, something I didn't believe in, over Jesus, who I desperately wanted to believe in. And it suddenly occurred to me that I was being an utter, utter idiot. Why would you stick up for something you don't believe in over something that you're desperate to believe in? And at that moment, it was the first time I'd ever prayed in my life. And I said, God, if you are real, and if I am doing anything at all, that you don't like, I'm sorry. I know I need you. I know I need you. And you know what? I was on a tube train and somewhere underneath central London, and God was in that tube train. Absolutely unbelievable feeling came across my whole body. And so much so that I thought other people were noticing. I was panicking, thinking, oh, I thought I must be glowing, something must be on fire. Those of you that are here this morning, something did end up on fire, but not in that instance. But there, and I really thought something physical was happening to my body. So intense was this feeling. And I just felt God speak to me. And he just said, I am with you. And it was like, oh. I looked around the tube train at all the other people, and all I could see, this is a bit weird, okay? It was like I could see in their eyes and out the back of their heads. And I felt God just speak to me in the moment, saying, they're all empty. They're all empty. But I'm in you. I'm with you. I panicked a little bit because I thought, what if I look at Jo, this girl that I quite liked, and her eyes were all weird. So I looked around at Jo and just her, she was just great. You know, she looked beautiful, eyes in, everything. She's just awful. But I just felt God say, you look the same to her, complete, complete. So I had a liberty then to ask her to marry me, and I did, and she did, and, you know, all the rest of it. But, God met me so much on that tube train. And from that moment, I tell you, life has been an utter joy. You know, talk about the highs that I was on with drugs. I've had nothing like that. It's been way better. Way, way, way better. There's nothing like it. And, you know, God's really, really, really transformed me. And I'm so thrilled with that. And I think that's one of the things that gives me a passion, really, when it comes to reaching others. Because I was the lost guy. You know, I really was. You don't get much more lost than I was. You know, I was the weird bloke sitting in the corner of the student union just waiting for everybody to go home, you know, because I couldn't be bothered anymore, you know. So I think God's given me a passion somehow to share what he's done in me. You know, I've been saved from so much, you know, so much stupidity, so much foolishness. Let's look at the gospel briefly. Just flick up Romans 1. We're going to look at this very briefly and then we're going to apply some of it. I can't see the clock sign, but perhaps you can just give me an indication what time we finished. Okay, oh, that's great. Great, okay. Now, I want to look at this just very briefly. I looked at it in a little more detail this morning, so if you want to go a little deeper, you could also always get the taper this morning. But just flick up Romans 1 for me, because I want us to understand that the root of all our evangelism really comes out of the message that we've got to share. And it's only when we've really got a deep understanding of what the message is and the nature of the message that we actually share it with a bit more integrity and a bit more earnestness. I've likened the gospel a bit like a diamond. You know, the most expensive diamond in the world is the Millennium Star. It's worth £100 million. Or it's insured for £100 million. It's actually worth a lot more than that. And I just want to compare the gospel to a diamond because, you know, a diamond has many facets. The gospel has many facets as well. And I just want to just use that as a comparison for a little while. I'm just going to read the first few verses of Romans 1. Paul, a servant of Christ Jesus, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, the gospel he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures regarding his son, who as to his human nature was a descendant of David and who through the spirit of holiness was declared with power to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord. So here's Paul. He introduces himself as a servant of Christ, a slave of Christ, somebody who's working for Christ. This is a word that any of us could describe ourselves as. We're all servants of Jesus. That's what we are. But he's also, contrasting it with this other title that he's got of an apostle, which is a much higher status kind of term. Literally means a sent one, but it's an appointment of dignity and privilege. So we've got Paul here. He's saying, I'm a servant, but I'm also a sent one with this message that I've got. And I just want to describe some of the bits of the message that we've got in terms of its nature. Firstly, I want you to understand, like a diamond, the gospel is pure. It's utterly pure. If you notice the way Paul describes the gospel, he calls it the gospel of God. So God by himself is pure, holy, divine. So the message that comes from God is by its very nature, holy, pure, and divine. So he describes it as the gospel of God. We're told that the scriptures foresaw that God would justify the Gentiles by faith. God justifies the Gentiles by faith. Therefore, God is the first evangelist. I love that. God is the first one who decided that this message was going to come to mankind. He announced the gospel in advance to Abraham that all nations will be blessed through you. So this gospel is a gospel that's come from heaven. It's a divine message. It's not our message. We didn't invent it. We didn't make it up. It's not just a nice string of words. It's not a good idea. It's a God idea. And the gospel has had that purity all through history. So we can see that it's the gospel that he promised beforehand, back in the Old Testament. So it's the same gospel all the way through, Old and New Testament. So Jesus knew that he was the, the Son of Man in Daniel 7. He knew that he was the suffering servant in Isaiah. He knew all these things because it's the same gospel all the way through. And Jesus himself preached the same gospel. We're told that he went into Galilee proclaiming the good news of God. Okay, so he's not just talking about himself, although he did spend a lot of time talking about himself, but he's proclaiming the good news of God. Now, because it's God's gospel, we need to take it pretty seriously. It's God's gospel, so we're not at any liberty to alter it, change it, fiddle with it, add to it, or remove from it. God decided its content. It's not for us to decide its content. And actually, Paul was a real stickler for this. He was always urging churches not to mix the gospel, not to water down the gospel with some kind of Gnosticism or asceticism by adding something to it or by trying to add some works to it. He was very, very clear about that. He knew that an impure or watered down gospel didn't really have any power at all, whereas the gospel of God has the power of God lacing it. Now, because it's the gospel of God, we need to take it seriously, so we need to be thoroughly biblical when we're talking about the gospel. Now, the danger is when people sometimes are thoroughly biblical about the way they communicate the gospel, they sometimes forget who they're communicating it to. Now, of course, we've got to be thoroughly biblical, but we've got to make sure that people hear and understand. So we've got to use contemporary language. I've got a friend of mine who I think he thinks he was born a Puritan. Whenever you hear him sharing the gospel, he speaks in King James. It's really odd. Right? And he's a lovely guy, but it's just really strange. We've got to communicate with people. John Stott used to describe it as a bit like a bridge. So if we're going to build a bridge of communicating the gospel into people's lives, we've got to have a foundation on both sides of the river. This side of the river being scripture, this side of the river being life. So he says you've got to build a foundation of scripture, but you've also got to have a foundation that is very much in life so that you can genuinely bridge the gap. So we're not just to have a liberal gospel that's all about touchy-feely, you know, it's great, you can do what you like, Jesus will still love you. That's not the gospel. It might be, let's think of some cultural values. You know, individualism, very high cultural value, isn't it? I'm my own man, I do what I want, I'm self-made man, I did it my way. It's the most popular song at funerals. You know, that's one of the values of our culture. So we tend to think of the gospel very individualistically. It's my truth. This is what I believe. It's true for me, but it's not, it's true for you, but it's not for me. Have you heard that one? I mean, that can't be true, can it? It's either true or it's not. Truth, by its very nature, is objective. Therefore, it can't be true for me and not true for you. It's either true for both of us or it's not true for anyone. Yeah? So we've got to land it in contemporary culture and make sure that we're not just honoring culture to such a degree that we forget the truth of the message. At some point, we have to tell people that Jesus died on a cross so that they could be forgiven of their sin. We can't just love them into the kingdom. We have to give them the message. So we've got to have a foundation on both sides. So it's pure, but it's also attractive because it's about Jesus. When you listen to the way Paul describes it, he says it's regarding his son, Jesus, who as to his human nature was a descendant of David, but was also declared with power to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead. So the gospel is actually really attractive. When people hear about it, it's good news. Why? Because it's about somebody that is very, very attractive. The person of Jesus is the most attractive person in the whole of humanity and his deity mixed in. That's what you see there. You see this twofold person of Jesus. You see his humanity descended from David, which means he's a man of flesh and blood like you and I. So he knows what I was going through when I was being tempted and falling and failing. I mean, he didn't fall and fail, but he knew what I went through. So that means he's a man just like me. So that means I can relate to him. It means he understands me. So the gospel is good news because I've got one who understands me that I can put my trust into. But better than that, he was declared with power to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead. So not only is he completely human, he's utterly divine and has taken my experiences way, way out of anything I would have anticipated because I'm hooked in with him and he's raised from the dead and I'm now going to live forever. Do you see how the dual nature of Jesus is just so attractive? Who else has raised from the dead that you can be included in? No one. It really is good news. Why do we share it so reluctantly and so lifelessly? This is good news. It's not, you're not some door-to-door salesman that's trying to sell a dodgy pair of tights or something. This is good news. You can share it with a smile. You can. It's life-giving news. It's about Jesus. So it's like a diamond. It's attractive. So it's pure because it's from God. It's attractive because it's from Jesus. It's also hard. You know, a diamond is a very hard substance. They use it industrially, don't they, for cutting through things. Now, I want you to understand, the problem of human sin is not a small problem. And there's nothing else in the whole of human existence that can actually deal with human sin other than the gospel of Jesus Christ. Okay, you can go to every therapy you want to, every self-help you want to. You can set up every kind of the smell will make you well kind of, you know, institution that you like. But nothing will cut through human sin and human pride like the gospel. It's hard. It's hard. Just listen to the way Paul describes human sin from Galatians. Remember, this is what separated us. Told in Isaiah, aren't we? Our iniquities have separated us from God. And there's a consequence to that separation, death. Told in Romans, the wages of sin is death. Here they are from Galatians 5, from the Message translation. See if this sounds like Bedford. It's obvious what kind of life develops out of trying to get your own way all the time. Repetitive, loveless, cheap sex. Stinking accumulation of mental and emotional garbage. Frenzied and joyless grabs for happiness. Trinket gods. Magic show religion. Paranoid loneliness. Cutthroat competition. All-consuming yet never satisfied wants. A brutal temper. An impotence to love or be loved. Divided homes. Divided lives. Small-minded and lopsided pursuits, the vicious habit of depersonalizing everyone into a rival, uncontrolled and uncontrollable addictions, ugly parodies of community. I could go on, says Paul. You know, I wonder, do you recognize yourself in that? I recognize my old self, not my new self. I recognize my old self in there so much. So much. Nothing else could have dealt with all of that. You've got a town here in Bedford that is riddled with this stuff. And you have the answer because you have the gospel. The only thing that will bring a solution to every one of those ills. So like a diamond, it's pure because it's from God. It's God's gospel. Somebody once said the gospel is not man's invention, but God's intervention. Okay? It's pure, it's from God. It's attractive because it's about the most attractive figure that ever lived. It's about Jesus Christ, the one that we love, the one that we sing about. It's hard because it's the only thing that will genuinely cut through human sin, human pride. Equally, it deserves a setting. All good diamonds should have a setting, a ring or a brooch. Now, you're that setting. The church is the setting for the gospel. Have you ever thought of yourselves in that way? You're there to display the gospel in all its splendor. A diamond without a setting is just a stone, really. Put it in a setting like a ring, and it's on display. You're that ring. You're that ring. Church without the gospel. So no, it's not a church, is it? But a church with the gospel demonstrates the beauty and power of God. I just want to challenge and provoke you in terms of your attitude to how we approach the gospel, how you do it individually, and how you approach it as a church. I want to pick 5 points and challenge your attitude. And those 5 points, who knows their vowels? Okay, you know your vowels? A, E. Very good. You were all listening at primary school, weren't you? A, E, I, O, and U. A stands for attitude. I want you to pick up a little bit on Paul's attitude in the next few verses in Romans. Just let me give you a few verses. This is still Romans 1, but I'm going to go from Romans 1, verse 14. Paul said, I am obligated both to Greeks and non-Greeks, both to the wise and the foolish. That is why I'm so eager to preach the gospel, also to you who are at Rome. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. First for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it's written, the righteous will live by faith. Let me just say to you, being and doing the work of an evangelist yourself is not dependent on your giftedness, on your maturity, or on your skills. It's more about your attitude. God can use anyone, even me, even you, God can use. So it's not about how long you've been a Christian. It's not about whether you're on the evangelism team. Okay, you are the evangelism team. You signed up for that when you put your hand up at that meeting years ago. Okay, or when you knelt beside your bed. Or for me, when I was on the tube train. I signed up for the evangelism team that day. It's what we're here for. What is your attitude? You know, evangelism. I've heard it said that evangelism is the only word that Christians and non-Christians hate. Okay? Isn't that a sad indictment of the church? Do you know, I had a Christian came up to me who wanted to join the church. And he said to me, just so you know, I don't do evangelism. And I said, just so you know, don't join this church then. He's been in the church with us now for 3.5 years. He does evangelism. Yeah, he's great actually. So what do you view evangelism as? Do you see it as a burden? Do you see it as a bolt-on? Do you see it as something that we've got a special team, they do that? Do you see it as something that's best avoided? No, I do pastoral work. I do the worship team. Don't come and find me. Maybe you're the opposite extreme. We do tend to polarize on some of these things. Maybe you are so rabid you're like an evangelistic Rottweiler. And as soon as you've got a non-Christian in your vicinity, you go, and you gum them to death. Or to life, whichever it may be. Or a Bible stuffer. You're having a conversation with your friend, and as soon as they open their mouth and there's a pause, you get the Bible and you shove it in and you ram it home till they're gagging. I was nearly put off Jesus for life because I met an evangelistic Rottweiler. It was one of the first Christians I met. I thought, crumbs, if Christians are like you, I'm not interested. She was scary. Scary. I just want to encourage you. Evangelism isn't something you do. Okay, it's not something, it's who you are. It's who you are. I was saying to the guys this morning, when we first started establishing Life Church Southampton, and I sat down with the trustees to go through the budget, the chairman of the trustees looked at me and he said, Chris, you've made an omission. He said, I can't believe you've left this out. I said, what is it, Fred? And he said, you haven't put anything in the budget for evangelism. I said, Fred, the whole budget is for evangelism. I don't need a budget area with the word evangelism on it because the whole lot is for evangelism. It's not what we do, it's who we are. Attitude. What is your attitude to winning souls for Jesus? Is it biblical? It's my question. Model it on Paul. Model it on Paul. A is for attitude. E is for eager. Paul said, I've just shut my Bible, that was a silly thing to do. Okay, what was the phrase he used? Verse 15, that is why I am so eager to preach the gospel also to you who are at Rome. So he did use the word eager. Now, somebody once said a cold church is like cold butter, it doesn't spread very well. Paul said he was eager, not reluctant, not cold, not hard, he was eager. He said, I am so eager to preach the gospel. Is that our experience? Why was Paul so eager? Why was Paul so eager to preach the gospel? Well, let me give you some reasons. First reason, Paul recognized the reality of hell. He knew the lostness of the lost. He knew that people were wretched and that worse was to come. And because of that, he knew he must speak. And I want to urge you tonight, if you don't go away with anything else, remember, please, tonight, how lost the lost are. There is no such thing as being a bit lost. You are lost. Have you ever been lost? I got lost once when I was three and a half. I was in the back seat of my dad's car. He was supposed to be taking me to I wasn't at school, but my mum was a teacher, and he was supposed to be dropping me off at the school. So I'm in the back of the car, and we're also giving another family a lift to another town on the way. So we drive along in the car. The car stops. My dad says, "Out you get, kids." I thought, I'm a kid. I'll get out. So I did. I just got out. Shut the door. Off goes my dad. Three and a half. In a town I've never been to, where I know nobody. And I can't see my dad's car anymore. And all the other children have walked off to school. What do you do when you're three and a half? Do you know what I did? I went to the sweet shop. I did. I cried a lot. And they filled me full of milk gums. It's great. I said, "Hello, my name's Christopher Kilby. My telephone number is Henfield 2489. Please, can you telephone my dad and tell him I'm lost?" And they did. They did. He came back in his camper van and picked me up. Yeah. It was when he told Mum that he really got roasted. But for the moments that I was stood on the street, I was horrified. I was so lost. I want you to understand, lost people are not a bit lost. They're lost now, and they will be lost in all seriousness. They will be lost eternally. Hell is an awful, awful place. A place of utter selfishness, where everybody's free to pursue their own selfish individual ideals without any reference to anybody else at all. It's going to be just horrific. But most people don't know it. From the way most people talk, you'd think it was air conditioned. It's not. It's awful. It really is awful. A friend of mine sat me down in the car the other day, said, "Chris, talk to me about heaven and hell." And he decided that he wanted to go to hell. He said, "I don't want to go to heaven where the Christians are. It'll be boring there. All the goody-goodies will be there. I want to go to hell where there's going to be a great party." And a shudder went down my back. And I had to say to him, "Pete, there's no party in hell. There's no friendship in hell. There's no laughter. There's not even a smile or a glimmer of hope in hell. All that's going on in heaven, where there's love and friendship and joy. None of that exists in hell." Listen to what Scripture says about it. This is from 2 Thessalonians. "This will happen when the Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven in blazing fire with his powerful angels. He will punish those who do not know God and who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. They will be punished with everlasting destruction and shut out from the presence of the Lord and from the majesty of his power." Shut out from the presence of God. Shut out from everything we know is good. Shut out from every piece of joy we have, every piece of warmth that we have in life, every laugh, every relationship. Shut out from the presence of God. That's where they'll be. They're lost, shut out. I do sometimes wonder if Paul had Noah in mind when I hear that he uses this word shut out. Because in the ark, it says that the Lord shut them in, into that rescue vessel, into safety, into security when the storm came and the rains came. But shut out. It fills me with horror to think what it would be like to be shut out. I know what I was like when I was outside of the kingdom. Still receiving common grace, still had friendship and joy, but that'll all go one day. That's why Paul was so eager. He knew how lost people were. There's another reason why he was so eager, and I've called this one the toaster bag principle. Okay, the toaster bag principle. Let me explain why before you think I've completely gone mad. Christmas, a few years ago, I got a very unassuming gift from my mother-in-law. It didn't look very impressive at all. It was a small, flat, wrapped-up thing. It clearly wasn't a book, so I wasn't that interested. Okay, but I opened it all the same, you know, generous spirit, me, Scrooge. Anyway, opened it up, and inside was this thing, small packet, and it said on the front, toaster bags. And I thought, oh, that's nice, thank you very much. And I popped it down with my other presents, went home, put it in the cupboard, and left it. And it wasn't until January came round that I was clearing through the cupboards, and I found these toaster bags, and I thought, I'll give them a try. And so I took it out. There was a little picture on the front of what you were supposed to do. Make yourself a sandwich, either a cheese and ham sandwich, or a cheese sandwich, or a ham sandwich, or a ham and cheese sandwich, or a ham, cheese, and mustard sandwich. It's my particular favourite. But you can make yourself this sandwich, and then once you've made the sandwich, you pop it in the toaster bag, then you pop the toaster bag in the toaster, you put it down, and 2 minutes later, up pops a toastie. So I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. So I got them a sandwich, made it up, ham, cheese, bread, put it in the toaster bag, pop the toaster bag in the toaster, put it down. Anyway, waited 2 minutes, pop, up it comes. I slid it out onto the plate, and I just have to tell you, it was the most divine toasted sandwich I have ever, ever eaten. It was crunchy on the outside. The bread was just springy on the inside, and the cheese was melted just to the perfect degree, so that it was lovely and stringy, but it didn't burn the roof off your mouth. You know the kind of cheese I'm talking about. It was just a... And immediately, I got on the phone to my mum, not my mother-in-law who bought it for me, but my own mum. I said, Mum, Anne got me this thing for Christmas. You have got to get yourself some. They're called toaster bags. You can get them... No, I think you can get them from Lakeland. Yeah, you can get them in Lakeland. I think they're about $4.99. They're called toaster bags. T-O-A-S-T-A. Not E-R. Bags. Toaster bags. Okay. You can buy... Yeah, they're fantastic. They make the really nice toasted sandwich. It's really crunchy on the outside, but it's really soft and gooey. Get yourself one. They're really fantastic. Okay, thanks. Put the phone down. And I thought, actually, I'm going to tell my brother, Colin. So I phoned up my brother, Colin. And I phoned him up. Dialed probably in those days. That's telephone. For those of you, this is not telephone. This is telephone, okay? So, showing me age now, aren't they? So, anyway, I said, Colin, I've got this thing for Christmas. They're called toaster bags. They're brilliant. Colin replies to me, I know, Mum's already phoned me and told me. I'm thinking, how did she get that message across so quickly? Anyway, this buzz was going around my family about how amazing these toaster bags was. Friends, that is Paul's eagerness with the gospel. Okay, in a nutshell, he has found something so good and so tasty and so alleviating of all the world's ails that he has to tell everyone about it. We've got that. You and I have you been saved? You have. You've got something incredible. Have you got hope and a future? Yes, you have. Have you got eternal life right now? Yes, you have. Peace, security, joy. You've got it all. You've got something pretty good. Do you know, my wife's grandmother, she died last week. Bless her, she was 90 years old. We're going to her funeral this week. She was somebody who had this principle so ingrained in her. She would take every single opportunity in life to rescue people and to win people and to give them the good news. You know, this lady, let me just tell you, this lady, her name was Papa, okay? That's what we called her, Papa. Do you know what? She had... On her kitchen table, every time she left her house, she would leave on her kitchen table a Bible and a letter. And on this letter, it said this, Dear burglar, please feel free to help yourself to whatever you need from my home. But please also take this Bible. Know that Jesus Christ loves you and died on the cross for you. And read these verses. She's never been burgled. But she's certainly making the most of the opportunities, isn't she? This woman doesn't let anybody get away. She sits next to people on a bench in the high street. And she sits there for about 5 seconds and then says, You do know the Lord, don't you? And waits for their response. This woman was amazing. I went to her, even when she was in hospital in her last week of life. She said to me, can you pass me my handbag? I went to get her handbag. I picked it up and I went up like that. What on earth have you got in here? She's got about 20 New Testaments. She just takes every opportunity. Every single opportunity. On her 89th birthday, she was taken out for lunch. And the waitress bought her the birthday cake at the end. And the waitress said, blow out your candles. So she blew out the candles. She said, now make your wish. So she made her wish. And the waitress said, I hope your wish comes true. Do you know what she said? It will if you pray this prayer with me. Bless her. Do you know, she is the most incredible woman that I've ever met. And she's now in glory, loving Jesus forever. Wonderful. Well, her funeral next week will be a celebration. Really will be a celebration. Sad though we are. Yeah, never got burgled. Unbelievable. So eager. E. A is for attitude. E is for eager. I is for inclusive. Inclusive. Paul said, didn't he, that he was obligated both to the Greeks and the non-Greeks, both to the wise and the foolish. Basically, he's saying this message that I've given you is for absolutely everyone. You know, I've been thrilled recently with the number of people that we've seen saved from the Sikh and Hindu community in Southampton. Had some real breakthrough in that area. And also the Polish. We're now on the verge of launching a Polish congregation made up of guys from our church and another couple of churches that have come together that are really wanting to reach the Polish community. But language is a massive barrier, and culture is too. So we're trying to handle this as we go. But actually, there's 20,000 Eastern Europeans in Southampton. Every single one of them is precious to Jesus. And I don't want us to have a white middle-class English student church. I want us to have a Polish and Nepali and Indian church. And a young people's church and an old people's church. I believe that's what heaven's going to be like. But Paul's saying that's who you've got to share the gospel with. He says Greeks and non-Greeks. Just think about that for a moment. Just do some computation in your head. Greeks and non-Greeks. Isn't that everyone? You're either Greek or you're non-Greek, aren't you? Yeah? Most of you are non-Greeks, I'm guessing. But you're one or the other, aren't you? Yeah? Paul's saying it's for everybody. You're either wise or you're foolish, aren't you? I won't ask you which of those you are. But it's just amazing. Paul wants everybody to be reached with the gospel. You know, when I was in Denmark, we used to sing a drinking song. And it went like this, okay? Vi skål dem og vore venner, og dem som vi kender, og dem som vi ikke kender, dem skåla vi mel. That's how it went. I'll sing it to you in English, so you know, this is my beer. Now, that's my telephone. This is my beer, okay? We say cheers to our friends and the people we know, and the people we don't know. We say cheers to them as well. That's Paul's attitude to the gospel. People we don't know, people we do know. Wise, foolish, rich, poor, male, female, Jew, Gentile, everyone. But application, guys, are there any areas of the town that you don't go to? Are there any people groups that you think, actually, we're not really called to that group? Are there people who make things seem a little awkward for you on a Sunday morning? Whose social behavior doesn't quite fit in with yours? Who was the last person you had a meal with? Out of the last 10 people that have eaten in your home, how many of them have not been Christians? And how many of them have been different to you? Paul was inclusive. There's nobody in the whole of Bedford that wouldn't be better off knowing Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. Nobody. What about the Muslim community? Do you feel God's going to give you some breakthrough in that area? Do you really feel God's going to give you some wisdom and some keys? It's like I can see you walking down streets and there's open doors all the way down the streets. You know, the Muslims are very good at doing community. Their doors are often open. Notice that in Southampton. The kids are out playing in the streets. I feel God saying to even stir you, walk some of those streets. Walk some of those streets in the Asian communities. See if you can serve in those areas. You know, we got asked by the Sikh councillor of the area where our church office building is. There was a shop front that people used to use as a toilet on the way home from the nightclubs. And the whole thing is derelict. It's just been ruined. And he said it's drawing crime to this area and people don't feel proud of the area they live in. Is there anything you can do about that? And so we just looked at it and we drew up some plans and we ripped out the shop front and we got our saws out and we got some new wood and we made it new. We put up some new signs and we painted it. It's just right opposite the Sikh temple. And we had loads of people as we were doing it coming down saying, thank you. Thank you. What are you doing this for? Why are you? And they were so grateful. It didn't take much. It was a couple of days' work, a lot of fun, and a bit of paint. Are there any areas of the city that God wants you to impact in that kind of a way? A, attitude. E, eager. I, inclusive. O is for obligated. Paul said, I'm obligated, both to the Greeks and to the non-Greeks. This is a sense of debt that Paul owes. It's the Greek word philia. It literally means I'm a debtor, I'm indebted. So for example, if I gave, let's pretend I've got £10. I haven't, but pretend I've got £10. And I give £10 to Nick, and I say, Nick, please could you give that to Simon for me? Okay, and then I come back here, and Nick doesn't give that £10 to Simon. He's indebted to Simon to the tune of £10. Until he gives him that £10, he's still under obligation, isn't he? It's not his £10, it's his £10, but it's been entrusted to him because I trust him, because he's a good guy, and I know he'll give it to Simon. In exactly the same way, Paul says, I have received an obligation. I've been given the message of the gospel. Yes, I've been rescued by that very same message, but actually it's mine to discharge. It's mine to give away. Do you realize right now, you have in your own head, in your own hands, in your own Bible, the words that will set men free? You have. I remember when Neville Chamberlain came back from his discussions with Hitler, when he was saying, I have in my hand a piece of paper that guarantees world peace in our time. A couple of days later, war broke out. That piece of paper wasn't worth diddly squat. You have in your hands, in your heart, the message that means peace forever for the whole of humankind. You've got it. You've got it. You've got something to say. You've got something to bring. You've got something to offer. So when somebody asks you the question, you know what to say, don't you? We just need to say it. I was just mentioning this morning, we did an event in a jazz cafe. And I was just sharing a bit of testimony, sharing a bit of the gospel. And I noticed that the manageress was really listening and hanging on to every word. And so I thought, I'm going to speak to her afterwards. And so I went up to her and she said, Debbie, her name is. She said, can I just ask you, she said, I've listened to everything that you've said. What do I actually have to do to become a Christian? I thought, I know this one. I know this one. You've got it. You know what people have to do to get their lives right with God. We just need to let people know. Most people don't know. They think they need to go to church or be religious, actually, or give to charity, even. You've got it in your hands. John Calvin once said that the gospel does not fall from the clouds like rain by accident, but is brought by the hands of men to whom God has sent it. It's not just going to fall by accident to your neighbors and your friends, and your work colleagues, your school friends. It's not just going to fall like rain by accident. God's put it in your hands. Obligation. I want you to feel almost, not a heavy thing, but a sense of heavenly obligation. Sense it. God has entrusted you to pass on his gospel of God to Bedford. Yeah? He's entrusted it to you. Will you take it? Will you take it? Last thing, A-E-I-O-U, unashamed. And this is where we're going to finish. Paul said he was not ashamed of the gospel. I find this fascinating. You know, in Mark's gospel, Jesus warned his disciples, didn't he, not to be ashamed of him. And presumably, Jesus warned them not to be ashamed because he had an inclination that they might be tempted to feel ashamed of him. Paul said to Timothy too, don't be afraid to testify about the Lord our God. So it's clear that Paul also faced the temptation to be ashamed. I find that personally quite comforting. Super Apostle Paul was aware that sometimes he felt tempted to be ashamed of the gospel and to keep shtum instead of saying what he really should. Gives us all hope, really, doesn't it? It does give us all hope. But actually, I wonder why Paul felt that temptation to keep quiet. My inclination is that I think Paul was tempted to keep quiet because something always kicked off when the gospel was preached. It rarely had no results at all. I mean, in 1 Corinthians, Paul describes it like this. He says, "We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles." Oh, great. The message that we've got is just like putting a great big rock in people's way so they can fall over. You can understand why he might be tempted just to bypass it a little. It's going to be foolishness to the Gentiles. Okay, so the message we've got is sheer foolishness. Well, it is a bit weird, isn't it? When we go up to people and we tell them, actually, do you know that there was a man who died on a tree 2,000 years ago, and because of that one death, you can have eternal life? It seems crazy, doesn't it? It is foolishness. It is a stumbling block. But it's true. It doesn't stop it being true just because it's difficult for us to handle. The gospel breaks open lives. It transforms things. You know, one vicar said, why is it wherever Paul preaches, there was either riot or revival, but wherever I preach, there's only ever tea and biscuits? The gospel, if we're genuine with the gospel, the church has left the gospel out for hundreds of years. Well, that's why there's only tea and biscuits. Because the church has not preached the gospel. When the church preaches the gospel, let me tell you, there'll be opposition, but there'll be breakthrough. Yeah, you're not going to be opposed if you don't preach the gospel, are you? There's nothing to oppose. It's like a bit of jelly. Here we are. The church. Look at us, we're the church. Yeah, you stay over there in the corner, you're harmless, you're helpless. The minute you're out in the public preaching the gospel, somebody will stand up and say, what are they doing? And then you know the war's on. And then you know you're taking it to the enemy. And that's where the victories are. That's when the sick are healed. That's when the dead are raised. That's when the lost come home. That's where it is. That's where it is. In the place of transformation. You don't need to worry about being ashamed. You don't need to worry about being ridiculed in any way, shape, or form. You've got such a lot to do. I'm really excited about you guys and your future. I think there is something so thrilling ahead for you. I want you to be prepared to be a little bit foolish. I want some of you to come up with some crazy ideas for how you're going to win the lost and reach the lost. I want you to come up with something that is so scary that even Simon is scared. Okay, when you suggest it to him. I always used to do this when I was an evangelist on staff at Winchester. I used to pitch my evangelistic vision so high that everybody would go, ah! So that when I settled for here, we'd get away with it. So I said, I want us to put a big article on the front of the newspaper, and I want us to say blah, 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 blah. So by the time actually everybody had had a debate, we actually agreed that there could go an article in the paper. It wasn't going to be on the front page, and it wasn't going to be this, but we actually got out there. But come up with some crazy ideas. Come up with some crazy ideas, and you'll find that life takes on a whole new angle. There was one more thing that I was going to say, which was, I don't even know if it's in my notes at all, actually. Now, I was just thinking, it's probably not here, but I was just thinking about Rudyard Kipling, and he didn't like the tambourine. So you come up with some crazy ideas. He didn't like the tambourine, and he went to William Booth and told him that he didn't like the tambourine. This is William Booth, founder of the Salvation Army, king of the tambourine. Rudyard Kipling didn't like the tambourine at all. This is what William Booth said to him. "Young man, if I thought I could win one more soul for Christ by standing on my head and beating a tambourine with my feet, I would learn how to do it." Are you prepared to do something so out there, so crazy, to glorify God, to win the lost? Do it. Do it. Don't be ashamed. The gospel is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. That's what Paul ends with. That's what I'm going to end with. Salvation for everyone who believes. It's the power of God. It will blow lives apart in a wonderful way. You should never be ashamed of it. You should never be ashamed of the gospel. It's good news. Why should I be ashamed? I've told you what my life was like. That was shame. That was folly. I'm not ashamed now. I've been rescued. My life's been set apart for use by Christ. I'm now going to live forever. Why be ashamed of that? Why be ashamed of that? Don't be ashamed. A is your attitude. E, are you? I, are you? O, are you? U, unashamed.